Downton Abbey, Season 6, the final season, premiered in the US yesterday to significant fanfare. The cast and crew of Masterpiece's hit about the Crawley family and their servants call historical advisor Alistair Bruce the Oracle because he knows everything about the customs and protocols of the time period. I spoke with Bruce about what the role of historical advisor means in practice.
Well, if you try to bring to life a period of time that really is quite distant now, you need somebody on hand to try and make sure that while the director works with the actors on delivering performance of emotion and style and things like that, I'm there to be sure that the protocols that they observe are right for the time. So every time we start a new scene, there are gathered the actors who will be taking part in the scene. There's also the director, the producer, and me. And the actors can shape what they want to be doing with the director. And then I'd make sure that it isn't breaking any rules of that period. Or I can offer to the director, why don't you do this or why don't you do that? Because that's how they might have been. And very often, by knowing a lot of the background to the protocols of status and where people were, you can often give a little bit of extra armament to the director to more strongly put across a point.
What was it that made you so interested in learning everything about the manners and customs of the period?
Well, my real interest started because I was inspired by television as a child, and I think this is why public broadcasting is so vital, because it opens people's minds to possibilities. And mine were the possibilities of trying to find out more about my history. I was just really, really interested in the why behind all the customs and cultures that surrounded me when I grew up. And I discovered that there were far more customs and cultures back in time, and each of them had started with a utility. And I find unwrapping that utility gives you an understanding of a piece of history that has passed before us. And I have always been interested in that, and it was television and radio that got me into it.
That's wonderful. So in terms of the utility of how the customs came to be, I think one of the things that strikes us most as over-affectionate Americans is how little they touch and hug. But there was a reason for this, right?
Well, you say Americans are over-affectionate. I think Americans and all of us in our time are reflecting the situation we're in. Once again, it's utility. And human beings want to be close. We justify our existence on Earth by how we measure ourselves in the company of others and whether we're happy with others and all those sort of important things. And so physical touch is a sort of instinct. After all, two people who fall in love are most definitely close to each other. And I suppose we try and equate that because it's part of our natural instinct. But why they didn't in the time of Downton Abbey is because it was only about 100 years before that people died of the bubonic plague. There was a real danger when two physical organisms came together that an illness would be passed from one to the other. And there still is, but nowadays we've got antibiotics and have been involved in mobilizing soldiers recently, because I'm a part-time soldier, to go to Sierra Leone, which is a country that had a culture where every man and woman, when they met, probably kissed three times. They don't kiss anymore. They don't touch each other. And that is, again, the reality of utility in life becoming part of the protocol of behavior.
And I think over the years, we've liked to speculate about what has made Downton such a big hit. I'm curious if you have any theories on why that is, or if you think that part of it is how real the series is and how intricate all of these customs that they have are.
Well, I think if we knew what it was that people found interesting in Downton Abbey, we'd sprinkle it on every project we ever did and we'd be successful. But I think that it's terribly difficult to isolate success and the reasons for it. I suppose I'm interested in the fact that a lot of people are reassured on a Sunday night when they watch it about looking at a time that is not their own, but where everybody knew their place. And there was a sort of reassurance about that. And things were very certain then. There was a concept of certainty that simply doesn't exist today. I think we live in huge danger. I think at the same time we have tremendous opportunity and we've never been more comfortable. And most people can afford to buy food and some people can afford to buy much, much more than they need. It's a very different time. Now, in the period we're bringing to life, I think there was a more identifiable and easy to assess danger between kings and emperors which of course came to fruition in the First World War. But at the same time, there was a sort of certainty about, and the protocols appear to enhance an even greater gentleness one to another. I'm not so certain that there isn't an equal amount of gentleness one to another neither.
Mm-hmm. Now, because you seem to know everything about the protocols and customs of the period, I hear they call you the oracle on set. I think I remember you talking about learning along the way, but I'm also curious whether they've ever asked anything that stumped you.
Well, it's a great honor to be called the oracle, and if I'm the oracle, then Delphi must be Downton Abbey. I think that you never know the answer to everything, of course not, and very often questions are provocative to a greater journey of learning. But you see, I have studied the evolution of customs, going right back to the beginning of the evolution of kingship. And because I'm an expert in Byzantine and English coronation ritual, which is the means by which we inaugurate our head of state as a monarchy, I'm versed in quite a lot of the gutsy elements of what went into the high points of a nation's expression of itself. So what falls out of that is how we live day to day. And I think that I'm lucky, because if you follow a path which is bound to give you a set of shelves in your mind onto which you can place books rather carefully, it's very easy both to find those books when you need them, but it's setting up the shelves in your brain which is the trick to being well able to deliver answers when you're required to give them. And I don't think I've been stumped so much, because very often there is a derived and clear guidance. And I know how people behaved at that time because I've made a study of it. Somebody will one day have to bring to life today for drama in, say, 50 years' time. I think they're going to have a much more difficult time because people's behaviours, cultural interaction between incredibly different attitudes, backgrounds, nations, pasts, will also make it more complicated for the me in the future.
Quite possibly. But you mentioned the evolution of the culture and protocols, and we just had our screening of the first episode of season 6. Oh,
I hope everybody enjoyed it. I loved it.
It was very good. But if you haven't seen it yet and don't want to be spoiled, tune out for a minute. Throughout the episode, it was really clear to me how much things had changed since season 1. It's darker. You've got this constant plot point of a further reduction of staff. You're seeing the Crawley's friends having to sell everything. It makes you kind of worried.
Well, I think Julian knows that people do mind because they care about these different characters. And they are, if they're watching the series at all or the season, they'll be wanting to see how everything ends, bringing all the loose ends into final knots. You know, it was a time of enormous social change. And if you were in a position of authority, then you were being taxed more highly and the cost of labour was going up. So inevitably, you're being squeezed in the middle and inevitably people will suffer. And that's what happens in life. You know, people who have great wealth, who are able to patronise the society in which we live today, will be hit if there is a huge change in cost of labour, if inflation goes up, if the value of stocks and shares, you know, all these things are real reflections of what's happening in the world. There is this sense of enduring determination in the aristocracy, and they will make whatever steps they need in order to keep going, because that is the nature of how they've survived to now, and survival is what they do best.
And throughout the series, the Crawleys have mentioned various people that we never end up meeting. Are any of those people who actually would have been the Crawleys' contemporaries? Are you pulling people out of history and giving them to Julian Fellowes to kind of work into the script?
Julian knows exactly what he wants to put into the script. And like me, he's a historian. And he knows who was up and who was down in the aristocracy at the time. So they do get reference. We tend not to bring people who actually were around into the show because it's quite difficult to then get bogged down in making them look identical and pursue particular strengths and weaknesses in their character. But, you know, he sold to charity the opportunity for someone to put their first name onto one of the characters. And so Atticus is a reflection of that. There was somebody who bid for it who was called Atticus, and so Atticus became the name of one of the people. Julian knows his history. He doesn't need much help from anybody, although he and I work closely together. And he has a vision. And, you know, there aren't many huge season after season shows that have been written by one man.
It is remarkable. But you worked on a special called The Manners of Downton Abbey. How did that original program come about?
Well, PBS have been remarkably generous to me, and Rebecca Eaton and Suzanne Simpson both have suggested that one of the elements that America has been interested in has been this issue of the very different culture and manners that is shown within Downton Abbey. So they suggested explaining the provenance of that manners in a documentary special might be a good idea. I loved doing it. You know, I get terribly excited about this stuff. I don't know quite why, but I think having followed it and been surrounded by it to a certain extent all my life, I love to unwrap it. And of course, so many of the protocols and behaviours that are in America were transported across with the pilgrims. It always amuses me to be on a large road in America and be overtaken by the sheriff. Now, the sheriff is an appointment that started in Saxon England before the Norman conquest of 1066, because the Saxon kings divided England into shires, and then they put their man there. And the king's man was the Rieva. Rie means king, Yeva means man. And so the shire Rieva is the sheriff. And that's come here. You know, so much stuff that was in Britain is now a part of your vernacular. And I think unwrapping all the strange detail in manners, and now more manners, I'm really excited we've done a second documentary special, gives me the chance to tell a bit more that I wanted to say in the first one. I could go on doing this forever because, you know, I'd love to tell all about the manners that go right back in Britain, the way the protocols operated, how people were, and you understand why they behaved the way they did when you understand what it is that drove them.
So more Manners of Downton Abbey. We're also very excited. It premieres on WILL on February 28th. In that first special, you focused on a lot of different aspects. So what are you focusing on for this new one?
Well, we just look at more of the elements of pressure that existed in people's lives and how they created or how society evolved the structure through which to manage it. It's rather like in the armed forces, we talk about enemy forces and the environment. And you can do something about enemy forces, but you can't do much about the environment. And the problems of the life they lived were like the rocks that a captain finds under the water as he steers his ship. Manners and protocols are the chart with which each individual was able to deal with those rocks and chart their journey through into the open sea of safety and good behavior.
In the first special, someone mentions how they don't know what the rules are for when a woman would wear pearls. And we never find that out. So are there rules about when a woman might wear pearls and when she wouldn't?
A lucky woman will be given pearls when she comes of age. And if she doesn't get them, then when she gets married. And most women who are given pearls will wear them all the time, no matter where you are. Okay. But there wasn't a rule you will be wearing pearls. It was a hugely expensive thing to receive, even in those days. I mean, real pearls. I don't care what people make now, they're generally not quite the same thing. But real pearls, you can tell them when you touch them and when you feel them and you roll them in your hand, you can get a completely different sensation. But you've got to remember that they're incredibly valuable, because if you don't wear pearls all the time, they die. Pearls will lose their luster if they're not close to skin.
Oh, okay. We've spent a lot of time talking about Downton Abbey, and I think that's where most of our audience knows you from. But you have done so much more. You're a commentator for Sky News, an author, and you also, I believe, serve the royal family today directly.
I do in two ways. I'm one of the Queen's heralds, which means that because I'm an expert in English and Byzantine coronation ritual and the state ceremonial of the country, how Britain celebrates itself, I was appointed to become FitzAlan Pursuivant of Arms Extraordinary. So I wear a tabard which has the Queen's coat of arms, which is an order of dress that comes from the medieval period that we still wear. And I lead her in all the great processions of state, like when she puts the crown on and goes and opens Parliament. I lead the procession. And so I set the pace by which she then walks. And, you know, that's a huge responsibility and privilege. And I'm also an equerry to the Queen's youngest son and his wife, the Earl and Countess of Wessex. He's known as Prince Edward. And she's Princess Edward, according to our strange and odd customs. So I've been working for them because I've known the prince most of my life, and I'm in the army now as a one-star general, or as you call it, a brigadier general. And I therefore have still retained military involvement and working with the royal family to both help chart the way in which the United Kingdom celebrates itself, but also look after the way one of the Queen's sons reaches out that extra special physical way that members of the royal family can carry the presence and role of the head of state into the life of the country in so many ways.
And you've also served as a member of the Scots Guard?
Well, the Scots Guards Regiment is one of the regiments that forms the British Army. And I did wear a red coat and a big black hairy hat and stood outside Buckingham Palace, which is the postcard image of London, really. And in that role, I not only did royal ceremonial duties, those wonderful with the great bands and music when we marched past the Queen in glorious panoply of pomp and circumstance, but also went to war with my soldiers to the Falklands in 1982 and to do other peacekeeping roles as I was required to do it. So it was a very active period of my youth.
That is remarkable. And I'm wondering how that's influenced the way that you're looking at questions that get asked in Downton Abbey or the moments that the King and Queen are mentioned or involved.
Well, I think when the King and Queen are mentioned, my interest in royal history, and you can't really be interested in British history without being equally interested in royal history because they're so intertwined, I try and make sure that people understand the way in which monarchy was viewed. And I try and point out that particularly after the First World War, the monarchy was incredibly popular in Britain because it had been this symbol of stability at a time of national challenge. And I think that's really what all communities do. I sense that in the United States now, as there's a danger about, people may have a political view about your head of state, because after all, your head of state, unlike ours, is a political being. But still, the office of president is a coherent one around which the nation seeks to rally. Sometimes politics gets in the way of that. But you see, when we rally around the king or the queen, there is no politics to get in the way.
In addition to guiding what we're seeing from behind the camera, I believe you have also had a few cameos. Where can we find you? And how has that experience been different than your usual backstage role?
Well, in all the seasons, I've had at least one walk-on part. And it came really when I started in film in The Young Victoria. I had a role in that. I didn't actually have a role in The King's Speech, which I was historical advisor for as well. But I was Maggie's butler, Series 1. I was a soldier who came with the general in Series 2 when they went out shooting pheasant. In Series 3, I was a Scottish gillie with a huge beard and a very smart kilt. And then in Series 4, we had a royal event where Lady Rose is presented to the King and Queen, and I was the Lord Chamberlain, my first speaking part. And then I was a brigadier general, only because I'd just been appointed one, in Series 5, which was a little bit of a humour for me. And then finally, in the last series, in the last episode, I speak again, and this time as a butler once more.
We will definitely be looking for you then. Thank you
my
very,
pleasure.
Very much. That was Downton Abbey historical advisor Alistair Bruce. Thank you for listening. I'm Amanda Hunnickfort.